So this is all during your uni days.
Yeah.
And school.
Yeah. I went to a school, a very small school, a new school that just started, and it was a very progressive, small P kind of school, and it was.
What did your parents do as some professions?
My father was a school teacher, and at that stage was a school principal, and my mother was a teacher too, but she didn't work much. I mean, she had eight children, you know, she didn't have much chance to work.
Yeah.
It was eight children spread over 20 years.
So, gosh.
That's a long time.
Yeah,
20 years.
Yeah.
She worked out, she made school lunches for 38 years. Or 36 it might have been. It was a hell of a long time.
Yeah, a lot of school lunches there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like it really was a very divided country.
A very divided country. I mean, my father was actually told by the education department that he was at risk of losing his position as principal if he didn't pull me into line. You know, that's one of the reasons they left the country. You know, it was just too hard to stay, you know.
And do you have siblings still there?
I don't have siblings there, no. They're all here.
Yeah. Everyone's here?
Yeah, everyone's here now, yeah. And have been for a long time, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got cousins and cousins over there.
Have you been back?
I've been back about 4 or 5 times, yeah. And
is that hard?
You know, I was reading a diary. I wrote a diary for the first time I went back, and it was hard. It's getting different now. Last time I went back was about 6 years ago, and there's no place for me there anymore. Mm. It doesn't feel like, you know, whereas at the beginning it was just after Mandela had been released, and they were doing this transitional government, transitioning to a new government and to a universal franchised election, you know. So it was during that period, a terribly exciting period, you know. And I just found it amazing. And the violence was just appalling.
Oh, you know, really?
Everywhere. It was so dangerous.
Were you a citizen of Australia then?
Yeah.
When you went back?
Yeah. When I arrived here, you know, I arrived at Perth Airport. My family were already here, and they said, "How long are you coming to stay for?" And I said, "I've come permanently," and they stamped me permanent resident. Having a white skin, coming from South Africa, you know, at that stage it paid off sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got my passport, I became an Australian resident. I went to a police station, I think, and I swore on the counter, you know, because I wanted a passport to go to England with.
Yeah.
And you couldn't, because South African passports were just terrible. You could go nowhere in the world hardly with them.
Oh, people would actually ban you.
Yeah. Lots of people. There were almost no countries north of South Africa I could have gone to. So I've never seen the rest of Africa, apart from Rhodesia, which was Rhodesia then. But that was about the only country that would let you in.
Gosh. So, but coming to Australia was easy.
It was easy, yeah. It was just at the end of the White Australia policy. I mean, we're talking 1972, you know. First Nations people here had only been given been recognised citizens in 67 or something. Yeah. It wasn't long after.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting arriving here because people denied the fact that Australia was racist. And I couldn't believe it, you know. There's the level of sophistication of understanding about racism was so bad.
There's a lot in that.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that people didn't think that they were racist but thought of themselves as almost rescuers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hidden racism, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
It's not even that hidden. It's just.
I don't blame people for being racist. Because it's very difficult if you're brought up in a particular way to not be, you know, because it's racist. I think it's something about the other, you know, where you don't feel part of them and they don't, you know, and they don't look like they're part of you. And it applies to gender. It applies to ability. It applies to everything. You know, it's not just and racism is stuff that's easier to kind of hang on to, and it's got a more of a history. Well, no, not more of a history, because there are more people who are black than who are disabled, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. Well, the other
is... It's a history of slavery, and it's a history of servants and lords and, you know...
Yeah.
Colonial history.
Yeah, that's right.
And for centuries and centuries.
The otherism is ableism, which is the same thing. People think ableism is just about people who are disabled, but it's not. It's about anybody that you perceive as different.
Mm.
Other than. And it seems to be a human trait.
And I think the only way you kind of deal with that is by getting to know. You've got to. I think you need people are other until you know them, and then they become not other. They can become not other in your head. You might have worked it out and think, I can't do this, I can't do this. But it doesn't work.
Well, you hear that, you know, people saying, oh, I don't mean you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, who do you mean then? Yeah.
But you actually stop noticing, you stop noticing after a while. And and then you know that you've actually cut through.
Yeah. Was there a single event that made you leave? That triggered it?
My family left. And I apparently had gone to see met with my parents. I was 19 at this stage. And I was getting a lot of surveillance by the security police. And they were, my parents who lived in a different town, were having their mail opened. Because of me. And their phone tapped and stuff, you know. And my father was being threatened with losing his job as a school principal if he didn't pull me into line. And so I went and met with him. And added to that was the fact that as a boy, you had to go and join the military. You had to do your military service. And they had started doing that in South West Africa. So it was actually frontline military service. You know, it wasn't just going to a training camp. And so I had a meeting with my parents and said, I really wish that they would leave. And I think I said, because they had five kids below me in the family too. And I said, you know, it's not going to get any easier if you stay, because, you know, you've brought us all up to actually think and see through this. And so everyone is going to do it, you know. So, you know. And so I said, I think you should leave the country and take them all, you know, get out now. And so they started. And friends of theirs had moved out here. So they started the process. And 2 years later they left. Yeah.
2 years later.
Hmm.
And did they know people here?
And I had to promise that I would come when I finished university as well.
Yeah.
You know, that was the deal. We had a deal going. Yeah. They knew people here living who lived in Narracourt, that's all. Our GP, someone who had been the family GP and family friends in South Africa, had moved out here a few years before. They were Narracourt, so they knew no one else. And they were... Yeah, my father was 53 and my mother was 46, I think. And they brought five children with them. And he had a job in a school that he hated.
Here?
Yes. He got a job at Erbre, and he was a Latin teacher and a history teacher in English literature. You know?
Yeah.
He couldn't believe it. And Urbright, you know, in yeah. the beginning, late 60s.
It was very upper class. Yeah, so called.
Yeah, yeah.
An agricultural school.
Agricultural yeah. school, yeah.
yeah.
Where no one was interested in learning anything apart from how to look after animals. Yeah. You know? That's yeah. what he used to say.
Yeah, yeah, and that'd probably yeah. be true. It's all the rich
it's
farmers.
It's how it was, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. yeah.
Yeah, but he got a job.
No, the rich farmers sent their kids to St. Peter's and PLC.
Oh, the, oh, okay.
Yeah.
The Urbray was for the
Urbray was government school, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of kids came from the hills
who, okay. you know, yeah.
who were going to take over the family farm.
The family
yeah,
family
yeah.
farm, yeah. yeah, so that must have been incredibly hard for them.
Really hard for them, but they said they never regretted it.
They never regretted it.
Never regretted it, yeah. yeah. And then the rest of us ended up here as well, so... I've got two, the first two in the family of two sisters, and one of them came when I came, and the oldest one was married and stuff, and she stayed for a few years and then came out as well.
And were they as activist as you were?
No, no, no. And I've tried to work that out. I mean, and it was a lot to do with gender, being a boy. And I went to a school that really encouraged you to do what you needed to do in life, you know. Whereas they went to convent schools, which certainly didn't encourage at that stage women, young women to take on the world, you know. Whereas I was, went to, my education was very much about, you know, that's your role.
And... girls were troublesome.
Girls were just trouble. Mm. yeah. yeah.
That was pretty much the same year.
Yeah.
In that era.
Yeah,
I think.
Be the same yeah. era as you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 It's just terrible.
It is, it is. I had three sisters, and when my father realised he wasn't going to have a boy, he made me the honorary boy.
Well, that's... he
gave me all his books and physics and things that I had no interest in whatsoever.
That sounds like what happened to me when I first came here. So, 1974, when it was women's lib time, you know, those early days of women. It was still called, proudly called women's lib. And I was one of the few young men who kind of got it, I think, yeah. because I had five sisters and I'd been brought up with a fairly, you know, vocal and mother, and a father who also got it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, and they declared one, I remember one bunch of them declared me an honorary woman so I could because otherwise they would have had to throw me out of the, you know, out of the kitchen where they were all meeting around the kitchen table.
Oh, that's
you know.
Hilarious.
I was deeply mortified.
Yeah, I bet.
It was
yeah.
just so patronizing.
Because for me it was meant to be a bit of a compliment.
Yeah,
to be the
well they meant
boy.
It that way too, but it wasn't at
no,
all.
No,
no. No, it's
It always meant for me that I couldn't have long hair. Because I was a boy,
yeah.
honorary boy.
Yeah.
yeah. As soon as they realised that I wasn't a boy, I ran away. But, so there's probably a lot of parallels in South Africa and South Australia particularly because... of its so-called non-convict settlement, unsettlement.
Mm.
But, I think the parallels are much closer with South Australia than perhaps the other
I think so.
States.
In fact, when I first arrived and went up to Brisbane and across to Melbourne, it felt like foreign countries.
Mm.
They felt like completely different countries to here, you know. And I just wanted to come back to Adelaide. It felt really safe.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
comparison.
In comparison, yeah,
yeah
that's right.
Yeah.
And the same with Sydney and Melbourne.
Brisbane just felt wild.
Yeah.
You know. And the stories that people were telling, you know, people I met and, you know.
Yeah.
about the police and stuff in Brisbane, and it was it was during Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
It was absolutely shocking. Yeah. And I, in my looking at all of this, I think government sanctioning police brutality. I don't think that that's exclusive to anywhere. I think it happens everywhere, but I think the apartheid era brought it to
an art form.
An art form, and also you couldn't miss it. You couldn't not see it.
You couldn't not see it, and you'd see it all the time. Mm. You'd see it on down the road, you know, with police vans as well, you know, and arresting people for being walking along the street
for being there.
No reason, and demanding that they, if they didn't have their pass on them, you know, they were thrown in the back of the Black Mariah and taken off, you know. It was really in your face all the time.
Were you scared?
Terrified, particularly towards the end. Yeah. I was involved in organising conferences, national conferences for the University Christian Movement. The logistics of them, because they were held in KwaZulu-Natal because it was, I don't know why, down there, but anyway, there was, maybe it was more sympathetic or something at one at that particular time. And I was given use of the organisation's combi van to buy all this food and supplies, and I was drove around and up from Pietermaritzburg to Durban, which is about 80 kilometres, and Pietermaritzburg's reasonably high, so quite steep to get there, and in a combi full of stuff, and it was, you know, I could go 30 kilometres an hour, you know, those old combi vans in those days, and I'd be trailed by the security police the whole way in their big white car with their sunglasses on and stuff, and I was, you know, 19, on my own, before mobile phones or anything else, absolutely would panic and freak. And because by then, people I knew had been killed by the security police too, you know. So there was absolute fear. I was terrified, yeah. And they had started, and they were banning people, and they could hold you for 90-day detention, which, without a trial or without any charges being laid.
You know. 90 days.
90 days, yeah. Mm. I think it even went up to 180 days, yeah.
And did you know people that happened to?
To be held, yeah. And people were being banned, left, right and centre.
Banned
means that you couldn't... You were kind of put in home detention, so you weren't allowed to leave your property to go and do stuff, and you weren't allowed more than one visitor at a time to come and see you, and you couldn't work in a school or a factory, or, you know, they basically kept you out of institutions at all.
And how long would that last for?
5 years, 6 years, 10 years. A number of people I knew were banned, yeah. And one, Basil, who ended up living in Adelaide, he was banned in Johannesburg and with his four kids. So they were four little kids, he and his wife. And she could go to work still, but he couldn't go do what he was, you know, because you couldn't work, you couldn't write anything and could be published in any way at all. And we'd go and visit a few times to their house, a friend and I, and we'd have to come along the back. You know, they were friends with their neighbours, so you cut in at the neighbour's house and you could go climb over fences and get into theirs, because the security police just parked outside their house the whole time. And if they had found Basil in the house with more than one other person, visitor, he would have been put in jail, you know.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
It's just incredible when you think about it. Mm. Yeah.
How did he get out?
He got an Irish passport. He realised he worked, you know, he could leave, and he could get, once he had the passport and bought tickets to leave. So he could get permission to leave his house. So he got, that was all done legally, whereas lots of people couldn't get permission to leave.
No.
And so they had to do it.
That's how they had to live.
Yeah. Well, they could, lots of people had to live like that, yeah. Other people had to escape.
Mm.
Yeah. Like Donald Woods, I think, he wrote about Steve Biko. Yeah, he had to escape.
Did you mix with African people when you were an activist?
When I was an activist, the organisation was it was the only student organisation with black and white students being members, yeah, at that stage. So, yes, that was very confronting at times. Because of their anger.
Mm.
And the anger when they discovered security police among their own people, which they always were, you know, they beat them up, you know, took the law into their own hands. And after one of those conferences, I and a couple of black students ended up in the Durban railway station. And we were either waiting for trains or waiting for someone to pick us up, I can't remember. But anyway, we were using the phone, you know. And I was phoning someone. I phoned up, I think it was probably my parents, and said where I was and, you know, on my way home. And then I said to, it was Stanley, Sabello and Justice. I think it was Justice too. You know, do you want, have you got change to use the phone? You know, and they said, we can't use that phone. And I felt so stupid, like absolutely mortified that I hadn't realised after spending this time with them that, of course, apartheid still existed, you know, in the rest of the country. And it was that was a very important moment for me, you know, realising that and that shame that came with not knowing, not noticing, you know, and just being so stupid and young and naive that I didn't get it, you know. So they couldn't, and then the police came and moved them on, you know, because they were standing, you know, with a whites-only phone and a whites-only platform, you know, where the whites-only trains came. And I just didn't get it. Some of these things, and I still feel bad about that one. I should have known.
Do you wear a lot of guilt? It's the, you know, the white guilt.
No, I don't feel no guilt. It's embarrassment. It's embarrassment, you know, because I thought I understood, but it was embarrassment that I had such a shallow understanding, and I was so naive, you know. No guilt. There'd be shame there if I let it take hold of me, but, you know, I don't like the notion of shame at all. I think it's an appalling, dehumanising, depowering emotion, you know, and it's best to be avoided if you possibly can.
So when you first arrived here, was it a happy time?
Yes, it was. It was, I mean, I didn't want to come, really. I only came because I said I would, I promised my parents I would come. I missed South Africa hugely, hugely.
And did you continued your activism?
Yeah. I continued here for 2 or 3 years, yeah. And then it kind of petered out, yeah. And politics changed in South Africa, and I didn't kind of get... It was the rise of the ANC, you know, when the ANC became... And that kind of moved across here. I had kids and was working and stuff too. But it was when Steve Biko was killed. That's for me, it was like the end. I couldn't cope anymore.
You were still in
school. I was here. No, I was here. And I was at my parents' house, and I saw there was a program about on the TV about Steve Biko. It was a few days after he was killed, I think. And I just lost it completely and had to leave the room, and, you know, I cried, I wept, yeah. And that was like the end, you know. It was like the end of that part of my life, I felt, you know. Mm. It was over, you know. Because I'd known Steve, yeah. And so you live through all that stuff, you know, all those... the Soweto riots and the school kids and, you know, being shot and all that kind of stuff. And here you felt so... I felt so kind of hopeless, you know. You know, so far away.
Yeah,
you know.
from it all.
Yeah. And by that stage, you know, South Africa had boycotts for everything, and, you know, by the time that all happened, it was all turning, and it was just the beginning of the end for South Africa anyway, you know.